Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. On Thursday, the 2014 World Cup kicks off with host nation Brazil playing Croatia. All told, 31 teams will play a total of 64 matches. And at some point, you can bet there will be at least one pivotal penalty kick that decides whether one team advances to the next round or not. In that tense football face-off between goalie and kicker, each is considering, should I go left or right? As Stephen Dubner will tell you, the best option may be to do neither. Dubner is host of the WNYC podcast Freakonomics Radio, which professes to expose the hidden side of everything. Dubner, along with the economist Stephen Levitt, is also co-author of the books Freakonomics, Super Freakonomics, and most recently, Think Like a Freak. We wanted to get his freaky take on some of this week's headlines. So we're going to begin with the World Cup. But first, hello, Stephen.
Hi, Virginia. How are you?
Very well and very excited about the World Cup this week, I must say.
Me too. I'm glad you are, because in my house it's a big deal, but in many houses near where I live, it is not a big deal.
Well, you know, given what you do, you have some perspective on this, all data-driven. So if you were a professional soccer player, let's go back to that kickoff. Lining up, what would you do?
Yeah, so the data are really, really clear. If you look at penalty kicks at the elite level, so the best players in the world, you know, they're pretty good at making these kicks. They can put the ball where they want to in the goal, and the keeper's standing there just 12 yards away. So kickers almost always go to either the left corner or the right corner, where it's hard for the keeper to get to. Keepers, therefore, almost always, even more often actually, jump to either the left corner or the right corner as the kicker is approaching the ball, because he kicks it so fast and he's so close that you kind of have to commit yourself. But as it turns out, if you really want to give yourself the best chance for success, you want to kick it dead center, which is extremely nerve-wracking and counterintuitive, because that's where the keeper is standing at the moment that you approach. But you know that only 2% of the time the keeper will actually stay in the center. He almost always leaps left to right. So if you really want to help your team win, you will go center. That's what the data says. Mm. But that's not what kickers do very often. And the reason, as we fathom at least, is that it has to do with incentives, kind of private incentives or personal incentives versus public. If you go left or right and make a great kick, but the keeper manages to stop it, well, you know, you did the right thing, but the keeper did a great thing. If, however, you go center and the kicker manages to stop it, then you just look like a pathetic fool.
That's what I'm thinking. Don't people get killed for this in the football world?
They do get. They get killed for offenses even less than this, or you have to relocate your family. So this metaphor, this is how we begin. This is the first chapter of Think Like a Freak. So it's true that it happens to be nice and timely with the World Cup starting this week, but really we mean it also as a metaphor for life in general, which is, you know, we're all driven by incentives. We often respond more strongly to the ones that affect us personally than doing what might be better for the greater good. In this case, the football team, soccer team versus ourselves, or in a larger sense, the world versus ourselves.
Well, let's bring that metaphor, draw out that metaphor a little. It's kind of subversive thinking. You're doing what nobody thinks you will do because it seems so obvious. Now, is that part of thinking like a freak?
I think so. I mean, I think the higher up you go in society, the more education you have and the more you tend to hang around people who have a ton of education, the kind of people who listen to public radio, let's say. We are deathly afraid of doing anything that's remotely obvious because it seems too, you know, simple, simplistic. And so a lot of our book, we spend kind of advising people or encouraging people to think kind of like a child often. Thinking like a freak is a little bit thinking like a child, which is don't ignore the obvious, be willing to think small. And I think if we could all be animated a bit by that childlike curiosity and trying to figure stuff out, we would be on the road to coming up with better solutions.
Yeah, so it's more about curiosity than just the data, which calls to mind Itaú Unibanco, Brazil's largest bank, says that according to statistics, Brazil's going to win the World Cup. Ditto Goldman Sachs, I think last week came out with that. But what if I were to ask you who's going to win the World Cup right now? What would you say? Is this about predictions?
One thing that you can be sure of is that most predictions are terrible. So Look, the human animal loves to try to predict the future. And in fact, if you go back to the beginning of, you know, humankind and the earliest religions and philosophies, so much of them were about trying to explain the inexplicable or predict the unpredictable, like what happens after we die. But the fact is that we spend a lot of time and effort and money on trying to predict the future, even though the data suggest that even the very best people in their fields, whether it's economics or politics or sports, they're about as good as a monkey with a dartboard. That's what the data say. And yet we put a lot of faith into predictions. And most people who make big, crazy predictions that are wrong, we forget about them. But if you happen to make one that's right, everybody remembers. So if I pretend, you know, I'll go ahead and say it here. I think Croatia is going to win the 2014 World Cup.
Okay, here comes the hate mail.
Yeah, if they happen to win it, I will be remembered forever for making this ludicrous but what turned out to be true prediction. If, however, Croatia somehow doesn't win the World Cup, it'll be forgotten fine. And so that's what the incentives to predict are strong. If I had to predict right now, I would predict Brazil winning the World Cup for two reasons, or maybe three. A, they're a good team. B, they've won it before. And knowing how to win at an elite level can be pretty valuable. And C, home field advantage is pretty significant in many sports, including soccer. Perhaps not for the reasons that people think, like crowd support or home cooking, all those kind of typical reasons, but for one big factor, which is unconscious or unintentional referee bias, which is to say, if you're a referee in a soccer match, especially where one call can be the difference between winning and losing, even if it's totally subconscious, referees tend to make calls in favor of the home team, if only because referees are human too, and the idea of being pelted by invective or something more physically tangible than invective by 100 or 150,000 people is a scary thought. And so the home field advantage is pretty significant in football.
Stephen Dubner's with me, host of WNYC's podcast Freakonomics Radio. He's also a co-author of most recently Think Like a Freak. We're asking him to teach us how a freak might interpret some of the big news items dominating the headlines this week. Well, let's go to a very large prediction that could have great implications for how we all live. New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman this Sunday, his column included President Obama's quotes about climate change deniers. Now, public opinion on climate change, a longstanding problem for policymakers who are hoping to cut carbon emissions. What's the Freakonomics take on this?
So I guess there's a few. The first is people say they respond to moral incentives, and generally they don't. So when you hear me say that, you may get angry or disappointed at least, because we like to think that we, you know, not only do we have good moral compasses, but we obey them. But the fact is that even someone who thinks that climate change is a big problem potentially and that we should respond to it, when you look at the data of what gets people to actually change their behaviors, moral exhortations come in nearly last. Money matters to some degree. The biggest factor that we uncovered, especially when it comes to something like energy consumption, is what I'd call the herd mentality incentive, which is that if everybody else is doing it, then you tend to do it too, even if morally you don't really care that much, even if financially it might cost you a little bit. So, of course, then the idea becomes how do you get a lot of people to get the ball rolling? And that's what we're looking at right now. I think one reason that we've had such a standstill in D.C. is that President Obama, who's super smart on any measurable scale, one thing he doesn't do very often or very well is try to persuade people without insulting them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what you see on all sides of this and many other issues. It's a very natural reaction to say, hey, dummies, I'm right here. You are wrong. Get with the program or it's too late. Even if the get with the program or it's too late part resonates with them, the minute you start calling names, even if you're in the right, your opponent is not going to hear the rest of what you say. Even in this legislation to limit carbon emissions state by state, one thing that really interested me is it was pitched as, again, a climate change action when he knows that people who don't like the idea of addressing climate change in this way aren't going to like it. It was curious to me why it wasn't talked about as a pollution issue or a clean air issue, which is what it really is.
So that, I believe, is part of the new tack for the Obama administration, along with using the term climate change instead of global warming. But we have to move on to another controversial issue. Your co-author and collaborator, Stephen Levitt, he's done a lot of research around guns, gun violence. Now, I'm curious about how the two of you are processing the recent bout of mass shootings and this renewal in calls for tighter gun laws.
Well, I should say that the recent bout is not that different from the next to most recent bout, which is not that different from the next to next to most recent bout. I mean, you know, we've got a country where there are a lot of guns, where the availability is relatively easy, and where in some part, at least as a result of those two facts, there are way more mass shootings than anyone in their right mind would want. So, of course, you naturally look to one to explain the other. Are our laws contributing to the number of shootings? So the best short answer I could give would be yes, but probably not the laws that most of us think about. In other words, most gun control propositions, at least of the past 20 or 30 years, wouldn't do a very good job of keeping guns out of the hands of the kinds of people who most typically use guns in a way that horrifies society, which is to say criminals, because whenever you crack down on illicit market, the illicit market has its way of working its magic, and those who have some kind of mental illness or instability where they might be aided by the availability of guns, and indeed some changes in gun laws might have prevented some of those shootings, but you're dealing with a population of people who have a set of evil activities in mind and are going to find a way to carry it out. And that is in some ways a different problem. So in this country, we have somewhere about like 300 million, maybe more guns in circulation. They're not perishable. They're not going anywhere. So you could choke off every single new gun from here to the end of time, and you're still going to have a lot of guns around. Then you have countries like in Scandinavia, where the rate of ownership is higher than here, and you don't have many of these crimes. So a lot of things that people are in favor of, gun buybacks, turn out to be, according to the data, entirely ineffective. What kind of person participates in a gun buyback? Somebody who was not going to use that gun anyhow for anything. And so you see a lot of posturing and a lot of heartbreak, but we don't see that the current type of gun laws that have been introduced or proposed would do what we want them to do.
I know you mentioned the controversy over climate change and not thinking that talking about it would change behavior. Of course, there was a big backlash to your findings that legalizing abortion had a great effect on lowering crime, more so than tightening gun laws. But I'm wondering about that. You know, you talked to the father whose child was killed in gun violence. You can say to them, tighter gun laws don't actually lower gun violence. I'm thinking that thinking like a freak could make for some pretty uncomfortable social situations. How do you cope with that? How do you cope with that kind of offense that thinking really in this very different way could produce?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, when you have the opportunity to explain yourself at some length and to have the person you're explaining to talk back to you, whether to offer a counter proposal or just to offer feedback of any kind, is really good. And it's better than just putting out a headline that says, you know, gun control will work or abortion lowered crime. One of the big steps in Think Like a Freak that we argue is that when you want to solve a problem, the first thing you need to do is put away your moral compass temporarily. If you make every decision based on what your moral compass tells you, you may sleep well at night, but you may not solve the problem very well, because when you let your moral compass tell you what's right, whether it's guns, climate change, abortion, politics, whatever, you will inevitably think you know the solution before you've even entertained a number of theories. And so that's this is a different way of problem solving. Thinking like a freak will definitely make you a little unpopular occasionally, but I would argue in the long run, it's good for you and hopefully it's good for society.
Much to think about there. Stephen Dubner, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Virginia. Great to talk to you.
Stephen Dubner, host of Freakonomics Radio, co-author of three now Freakonomics books, most recently Think Like a Freak. There's more in the book, a leak to Freakonomics Radio's podcast at wordofmouthradio.org. And Stephen, for the record, Croatia, his pick for the World Cup championship. You heard it here first.
You heard it here first and last, probably, yeah.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The World Cup kicks off in Sao Paulo on Thursday at an estimated cost of $11.5 billion, the most expensive cup ever staged. While government spending and efforts to spruce up or knock down poor neighborhoods have set off street protests and led to charges of corruption, one expenditure is being mostly praised: the funding of the Walk Again Consortium. That's a team of scientists and engineers from 25 nations developing what is bound to be one of the most memorable parts of the World Cup's opening ceremony. The goal is for a paralyzed person to rise from his or her wheelchair and make the first kick of the games with the aid of a mind-controlled exoskeleton. Danielle Elliott traveled to Sao Paulo to see the exoskeleton in action and wrote about it in The Dream Kickoff, an article for Grantland. Danielle Elliott, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Danielle, this must have been a fascinating thing to see. I've seen videos of it. But first, your description. What did you see? What it looks like, what it's made of, and how a person actually wears this suit?
It really is fascinating. It's almost like a spacesuit that has all of these exposed wires and tubes on the back. And the tubes are hydraulic, and they're connecting what would be the shoulders to the legs. And they're filled with different oils every day to help them run. And how I saw it in the lab in Sao Paulo was that it's suspended from the ceiling, and they help put the person into it.
Mm-hmm.
But once it's placed onto the ground, you're standing in it, and your thighs and your calves are Velcroed into these straps to hold them into metal leg braces. And on their head, they're wearing kind of looks like a swim cap with a bunch of dime-sized holes in it. And those actually have the sensors. They're called EEG sensors. Those are reading the signals sent off by the neurons in their brain. And then over the top of that, they're wearing what just looks like a bicycle helmet. And that will keep them safe in case anything happened, in case for some reason they fell. That way they're wearing a helmet. And it also just makes them feel more secure overall.
And when you saw it in the lab, were there actually people who were paralyzed placed into the suits, or were these just other test cases?
There's four rooms in the lab, and in one of them, there's what they call the simulator, and it's a very similar apparatus that's attached to a stand attached to a treadmill.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw a paralyzed person in the simulator, but Dr. Nicolelis is guarding this project so heavily, and he just said for me to be in the room while a patient was using the actual exoskeleton was just too much of a distraction. So he hasn't allowed any media in the room with the actual exoskeleton while it's in use.
Wow, I can just not imagine somebody who's been unable to walk or support themselves suddenly standing up. And tell us more about this Dr. Nicolelis, Miguel Nicolelis. He's a neuroscientist at the helm of an international collaboration called Walk Again. It's a mind-controlled skeleton. Tell us a little bit about his background and what led him here to the World Cup.
So Miguel is one of the most fascinating scientists I've ever interviewed, and he's just this huge character who is so in love with soccer and so in love with science, and he just sees the World Cup. From the first time I spoke with him in January, you know, he just described how opening ceremonies are so often about arts and music, and he just wanted the world to see that Brazil is a hub for science and for scientific research. And he said, what better stage than the World Cup stage? And he also just sees this opportunity as a chance to get kids in Brazil thinking about science as an opportunity. And he said, you know, they don't have to just think about soccer. So he's just this larger-than-life character who loves soccer. And every interview I had with him, he talked about the exoskeletons, he talked about science, but more than anything, he talked about soccer.
Well, he's got a great stage for it. Tell us a little bit about the origins. When did Dr. Nicolelis start to develop this exoskeleton?
This is something he's really been working on his entire career, so more than 30 years. His initial research was at Hahnemann University. He was helping develop sensors that could read multiple neurons at the same time, because at the end of the day, fast forward 30 years, it's reading those neurons that allows this exoskeleton to work the same way that your brain would normally send a command down your spinal cord to your muscles. But in people who are paralyzed, that throughway has been cut off.
That is what is so game-changing about this. I can imagine, you know, fitting somebody with a skeleton and maybe programming it to do something, but this is actually working on the brain. Now, this project did not get funding from the Brazilian government until 2013, I read in your article, which is a really quick turnaround. How have they been preparing the 8 potential patients for this big day?
It has just been an incredibly fast turnaround. But as Dr. Nicolelis has said to me over and over, it will be done on time. He was actually surprised by how fast the patients really mastered the technology. He said he expected it to take them a few weeks, but within a few hours, they were able to control not the actual exoskeleton, but a virtual avatar. So now it's really a matter of the hardest part for them has been working with physical therapists and just getting their bodies accustomed to being upright again, because some of these people haven't stood upright for over a decade.
Yeah. And balance, things like that, I would worry about.
Yeah, absolutely. The hours they spend with the physical therapist are really the most intense part of this process for them. And then for Dr. Nicolelis, it's also the working with the engineers and getting this right, because this project really crosses over. It's not basic research anymore, and it's not rehabilitation. It's also engineering. So he's touching on so many aspects of science.
And the pressure must be intense, but I'm trying to understand why unveil the bionic exoskeleton at the World Cup, you know, with the biggest audience in the world when the stakes are so high?
He would say, why not? Why not get people excited about science? But a lot of people have wondered if this is too much spectacle, especially in the science world. It's not common to see something like this unveiled on such a huge stage. But he just says, you know, it should be. People should see this and get them excited. And people who are tuning into the World Cup are not necessarily the same people who would normally be tuning in to a scientific demonstration. So he just says, you know, this is how we'll reach larger audiences. What better stage than the World Cup?
Well, we're getting a lot of news about Brazil's preparedness and social unrest about the World Cup, plagued by a few problems so far. How likely do you think, Danielle, that this is going to go off without a hitch?
Based on having met Dr. Nicolelis, I think that this is going to happen. I mean, I'm not a scientist myself, but having met him, having seen it in action, having met the patients and seeing how dedicated they are to this, I'm hoping it goes off. I can't say that I'm 100% positive it will, but I think it will. His passion for this project is just amazing.
So any implications beyond the World Cup? What happens with this exoskeleton research after all of the furor, the funding, and the excitement has died down?
So this is actually one place where it looks like all of the money poured into this project will continue to help the people of Brazil, because they have a universal healthcare system. And Nicolelis spearheaded and is the scientific director, I believe that's his title, of a neuroscience research facility in the northern state of Brazil. And he said that those exoskeletons will be there. They'll continue to do research with them. His hope is that these are just prototypes and that many more will be developed so that paralyzed individuals across Brazil have access to them.
Okay, Danielle, we're going to go with your hope on this one, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Danielle Elliott there. She traveled to Brazil to report on the progress of this bionic exoskeleton that's being developed for the World Cup and beyond. 8 people are now in training to be the person to make the first symbolic kick at the World Cup. We'll have a chance to see that live this Thursday. But for now, you can look online, and we have posted some videos of people inside of these exoskeletons at wordofmouthradio.org. Truly amazing. Besides being the season for World Cup fever, tis also the season for an easy beach read. Perhaps The Fault in Our Stars is on your list. No shame in that. Or is there? When Word of Mouth continues, should adults be embarrassed to read young adult literature? We're going to step into that fray after the break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. A film adaptation of the young adult novel The Fault in Our Stars easily thumped the competition at the box office this past weekend. Its success was nearly guaranteed, says our guest Ruth Graham, who's been assailed for an article she wrote for the Slate Book Review. In it, Graham observes the growing number of adults reading YA novels and, here's the kicker, says that adults should be embarrassed about reading literature for children. She's here to tell us more. Ruth, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much.
Nice to have you back. You are, of course, not the first critic to dismiss YA as juvenilia, but triggered quite a lot of rage. What do you think?
Well, I think it was that line, you know, that adults should be embarrassed. And as I learned this week, people really do not like to be told that they should be embarrassed. And I have to say, you know, that line is probably, I won't go so far as to say I regret it, but I am regretful that that's the line that has attracted this rage that I think has kind of distracted from the broader and, more moderate point that I really wanted to make, which is just that we should kind of step back and think about what it means that adults are now spending so much of their time consuming so much of this literature that was written for children.
How much?
Well, there's about 50% of the YA market now that that is bought by adults. 50% of YA books are bought by adults. So it's remarkable.
I want to boil this down here. Clarify that we're talking about books like, let's say, Eleanor and Park. That's a big one. Mm-hmm. If I Stay, The Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Exactly.
Those are all big
YA books.
Now, is it for you that YA is not meant for adults, or it's not good literature, or both, or...
Well, it's certainly not that it's not good literature, but it is that it's written, by definition, is written for children under the age of 18. I mean, children has its own definition, but in this case, I'm talking about not adults. So one question is whether or not it's as sophisticated as the most sophisticated adult literature. And I should also clarify that I'm sort of leaving out the whole fantasy genre. I'm not talking about The Hunger Games. I'm not talking about Harry Potter. I'm talking about stories about real teenagers who are involved in sort of real life situations and that could plausibly be said to be replacing realistic fiction, adult literary fiction in the lives of adult readers. I don't think there's zero place for it in the lives of adult readers, but I do think we should think of it as a little bit of a guilty pleasure. I don't think it's as sophisticated as the best literary fiction.
Well, why not? Why no Hunger Games? Why no fantasy dystopian novels?
Well, my sense is that no one confuses The Hunger Games for great literature. So that's sort of – it's something that people read for fun. They read on the beach, and that's what it is, and no one's confused about that. Books like The Fault in Our Stars, this quote-unquote realistic fiction genre, I feel like there is starting to be some confusion and some blurred lines there between that particular genre of YA literature and adult literary fiction. It's the stuff that could be replacing it.
But readers argue they connect with it. So it is a kind of guilty pleasure for people. What's wrong with that?
There's nothing wrong with a guilty pleasure in its place. And I'm certainly not saying, or I think it's worth clarifying that the idea of a guilty pleasure has never been about people, you know, staying up all night worrying or like self-flagellating or just really feeling oppressive shame about the cultural products they're consuming. The point is that when you're consuming a guilty pleasure, you're aware that you're sort of indulging in something lighter and fluffier and more purely fun and maybe less enriching, all these sort of loaded judgmental terms, but then what you could be consuming. So, for instance, I read detective novels, which I think of as a guilty pleasure because they're formulaic and there's this guaranteed satisfying ending, and they're a lot of fun, but I'm also aware as I'm reading them that it's a bit of an indulgence. And if anything, that adds to the pleasure, and that's great in its place. But I don't like this creeping sense that, in which a lot of my very smart girlfriends have told me who love YA, you know, oh, you've got to read this book, and it's just sort of just as rich and just as sophisticated.
That is one of the points that I read, or an accusation, if you, in response, that you painted it with too wide of a brush, and that there are a lot of great YA novels.
Well, I have to say, I read that criticism, too, and I thought about it. And I'd read more books, I will say, in preparation for writing the piece. I read more books than those I called out in the piece. But I did – there was one of these response pieces that was an anti-YA list of, you know, let's make this list of rich, complex literary fiction that will sort of prove, you know, here's the good stuff that – Ruth didn't read. And I read one of them this weekend and tried to read with an open mind and give it a fair shot. And I thought the same thing that I thought when I was reading The Fault in Our Stars, which is this is a perfectly lovely book that's written for 13-year-olds. It was a very easy read, and it had a nice surprise ending. I don't want to call it out by name, because my point is not to bash YA authors or teenagers or even anyone who reads YA occasionally. I'm not out to bash specific books. But I will just say that reading this one particular book that I'll leave unnamed didn't convince me that it wasn't written for tweens.
We're talking about a debate that erupted online over whether adults should be proudly reading young adult fiction. And with me, the woman who started this tempest, Ruth Graham. So is it that people read YA novels, Ruth, or is it that there's a kind of pride that has turned what was once secretly consumed into a kind of public movement?
I think that's exactly it. Part of the reason I decided to write this is this creeping sense, I guess, or this creeping mood I'm getting from the culture where reading is reading is reading. And anything, there's no such thing as an indulgence, because a book is a book is a book. And it's sort of rude to try to make distinctions between them or to say that one kind of book is more sophisticated than another. And I guess I do think there are such things as bad books. And again, I'm to be clear, I'm not saying that all YA novels are bad novels, but I don't think that a book is a book is a book. I think it's possible to say there's high and low still, which is quickly becoming an old-fashioned idea.
What it calls to mind is this larger trend of questioning what is adult. I mean, more than half of YA books bought by those over 18. The majority of comic books and video games are purchased by adults. We wear sneakers to work. We ride skateboards. We want to hear all the newest bands. Is it that youth culture is just taking over?
I think that's absolutely part of it. Someone said to me after I published this, you know, you should next do a takedown of adults who vacation in Disneyland without kids. And I think it's absolutely part of that phenomenon. And I don't want to wade too deep into just sort of waving a wand over all of that and condemning all of it. People find fun where they find fun. But I think it's absolutely part of that larger trend.
Well, so in considering this YA genre in general, you know, you have the happy ending and the bad people, bad things happen to them, the good people, good things happen to them. That's the kind of logic of this universe. And I was thinking about books that I have read about, teenagers and young adults over and over again. Nearly everything by Jane Austen. Definitely Jane Eyre and Wuthering Heights from the Bronte sisters. And I have been, taken to task mostly by a particular ex-boyfriend about, you know, you're reading books for girls.
Yeah, there's a long history of, cultural authorities, often men, telling women and children, I guess, you know, that their reading isn't up to snuff and isn't serious enough. And if you go back to the 19th century, there are people saying that all novels are just women's fluff. I certainly don't agree with that. But I would say that just because that history exists, and I do think that's feeding into some of the backlash to this article, doesn't mean there's no such thing as fluff or that we can't make distinctions. So I love Wuthering Heights. I love Jane Eyre. I don't want to throw those onto the bonfire. I think they're significantly richer than a lot of the contemporary YA fiction that's out there.
You've just hinted at the kind of population that reads YA, which is probably why people are upset. Mm-hmm. But I did notice some themes in the responses. YA gave me a lifeline when I was younger that no one else gave to me. I was made to feel ashamed. This is my defiantly unpretentious reading list. It connects me to a younger self. Anything come across to you that made you reconsider why people boldly and proudly read YA?
Yeah, I mean, you've hit on a lot of themes there that have come up over and over, which is pleasure, which we've talked about, nostalgia, comfort, catharsis. And far be it from me to tell anyone that those are not valid reasons for reading. But I would say the same thing, you know, in a way it's like swimming in the kiddie pool and only swimming in the kiddie pool. It's fine in its place, but when we take a look around at the culture and more adults are spending all of this time in the kiddie pool, I just don't know if it makes me a rabid elitist to be a little bit discouraged by that.
I'm willing to bet that a number of writers, readers, and book reviewers would agree with you, but may not dare to say so now. Do you think the response to your article might have a chilling effect on criticizing YA?
Boy, I can only imagine. I have to tell you, I've gotten, you know, there's been a lot of public anger, and I've gotten some very supportive private emails from smart people I respect a lot who have sort of said, you know, thanks for saying what a lot of us are scared to say. So I hope there's not a chilling effect. I hope it starts a conversation about the place of YA in our culture.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Freelance writer Ruth Graham wrote the article Against YA for the Slate Book Review, and we'll probably be hearing about it for a long time. There's a link to read it and some responses at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, what about you? Do you think YA novels are just as worthwhile and literary as grown-up books? Are they more than a guilty pleasure? Or do you roll your eyes at seeing so many adults reading books meant for the 12 to 17 crowd? You can let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. That's where the conversation is already heating up. Siding with the YA crowd is Kevin, who references The Hobbit, A Wrinkle in Time, and Watership Down. Jamie agrees, saying, who cares, so long as somebody is reading. Jill thinks Ruth's argument is snobbish, joyless, and old. Ouch. Jessica, on the other hand, says she is not impressed with the better-than-reading-nothing argument, saying that there are so many books aimed at adults that could do a better job raising the level of discourse and vocabulary. You can weigh in with your thoughts at facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. And while we've got YA on the brain, we thought it was worth mentioning that while Ruth may not think the tearjerker teen novel The Fault in Our Stars can stand shoulder to shoulder with adult literary fiction, the movie adaptation is blowing up the box office, and critics are on board. The film boasts an admirable 82% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
One day I'm going to blow up, and I'm going to obliterate everything in my wake, and I don't want to hurt you.
You don't get to choose if you get hurt in this world, but you do have a say in who hurts you.
I am in love with you, Hazel Grace.
Among the dissenters who were less enthused with the movie is Dana Stevens of Slate, who said, what in the name of God is wrong with me that I didn't cry once? I, who just the day before wept through the entirety of my child's thoroughly upbeat school play. Well, whether you're a weeper or not, thank you so much for joining us today. And if you like what you heard, there's much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us or send us your feedback and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, inviting you back for more tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.